Hey, it's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. I am right now in the men's room at Shorty's, which is a bar in Seattle's Belltown neighborhood. And I just got to call our intern really quick.
Hello?
Hey, you want to introduce yourself and tell me where you're at?
I'm Bree Ripley. I'm your intern, and I'm in the women's bathroom of Shorty's.
So you're in the ladies' room, I'm in the men's room, and we're both talking into our own microphones, so don't be fooled. We're not sharing a stall or anything. So this week's show is all about toilets?
Toilets.
It's a whole hour on toilets. And so I figured that like a nice way to start might be to come to a well-traveled public restroom and take in some of the kind of haiku-like literature that people leave behind here. So we're going to read some of the graffiti on the walls. And be warned, this is graffiti on the walls of a bathroom. Why don't you start, Ripley?
Well, we've got a little piece right here that says, "I would rather die than live life on my knees."
So here's another inspirational one. "Luck helps along the path. Persevering keeps you upon it."
"You sprinkle when you tinkle. Please be neat, sweetie, and wipe the seat. Love you."
Aw, that's sweet. It took an old one and it sort of put a nice personal twist on it.
Yeah, it makes you be a little bit more considerate to your fellow restroom goers.
Here's a quote from somebody I've never heard of. "Your walls are my walls and ceiling and floors."
"I love you, Gerard Van Dyke."
This one is a classic. You ready?
Ready.
"Here I sit, brokenhearted, came to bleep and only bleeped." You've heard that one before, right?
I mean, who hasn't? I mean, we all use public bathrooms.
And you can fill in the blanks yourself.
"I'll be a Supreme Court justice one day. Look me up. Just wait."
Here's another one. This is deep. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
"There's no morals, no true laws. There's just doing right by people and not John Constantine."
Wow.
So think about that when you're, you know, taking your time in the stall. So, I don't know what we can conclude about the state of restroom graffiti. I feel like when I was a kid, there was a lot more. There were a lot more phone numbers, and I don't see any phone numbers in here, or email addresses, or even Twitter handles. It's all pretty much, self-contained. They're not inviting anyone to call for a good time of any sort, and I feel like there was a lot more of the like bathroom poetry back in the day, like, you know, "Here I sit, brokenhearted, et cetera, et cetera."
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I kind of miss that. But on the other hand, there is some profundity making an appearance on these walls as well.
Yeah, it's definitely deep and has connections to something that's greater than just your average bathroom quest.
Well, there is often profundity lurking just below the surface when it comes to toilets, and that's why we decided to spend a whole darn hour on it this week on Sound Effect. We'll have tales of toilets as a way to glimpse our true nature. That's coming up in just a few minutes, but first, as always, we have invited a bunch of friends over to talk over the week's news, so don't go away. How's that for a segue, Ripley? Well, I'm here with our group of keen observers to talk over the week's news once again. I would like to welcome Sarah Ann Lloyd, who is one-third of the Seattle News and Politics blog Seattleish. Phyllis Fletcher is managing editor of the Northwest News Network, and Aaron Burkhalter is senior reporter for Real Change. Hey, guys, welcome to Sound Effect.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
So this week, for our top story, the whole national conversation on race and identity has kind of trained its sights on Spokane, Washington, and of course I'm talking about the curious case of Rachel Dolezal. And we're, you know, a week and a half into this story. It seems like it's changed a little bit every day. But a good place to start, I think, is something that you wrote, Phyllis, this week in the Seattle Times. It was an opinion piece in which you made the point that
at least according to a friend of yours, you have probably been engineered by scientists to comment on the Dolezal affair. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Right, yeah. So what he meant by that, when he said that, he was referring to a number of things. First of all, I have a bureau reporter for Northwest News Network in Coeur d'Alene and Spokane. And I have covered racial passing as a journalist. And I happen to be biracial, what a lot of people maybe would call a light-skinned looking black woman. So my dad is black. My mom is white. My dad grew up in Pasco. My mom grew up in Prescott, which is 20 miles north of Walla Walla. So I also have the whole Eastern Washington thing going for me. And it's funny because when I sat down to write that, you know, I was starting in all these other places. And then I felt like the fact that if you put me in a room with her and a bunch of other people who are identifiably of some other race, people would say, are you guys sisters? I felt like that was, for me, like the elephant in my own room, and I needed to address it. And so I decided, let me just start there and then just let the rest of it flow from there.
A lot of the conversation has been around, like, what is racial fluidity, right? How fluid are our racial identities and stuff like that. And there was an interesting piece in the Seattle Times by friend of the show, Nina Shapiro, who talked about how, you know, multiracial people have a certain amount of fluidity in their identity, and some people identify differently in different situations or at different times in their life. But the advocate in her story said, but it's got to be based on something. It can't just be made out of whole cloth just for no reason. So, Sarah and Lloyd, I mean, have you thought about that? What do you think the limits of this fluidity are?
So I was talking with my co-panelist before the show about taking up space in this conversation, and I feel like the fluidity does not reach me as a white person. So it's not necessarily for me to comment on that aspect of identity. There are so many great conversations happening about identity and intersectionality as it applies to race. And I feel like there is a tendency within whiteness to feel like you are entitled to every space and conversation that you see. And I think that she's an important reminder that this is not always appropriate, that these conversations have been going on without you and they can continue with you as a observer. There was a casual conversation before the show about whether or not this is the most overreported story, right? And thinking about, like, as a white person, I can't really say when this conversation is over because I can't tell people how to feel about it, especially people of color, and tell them when the conversation is over.
This conversation has changed over the course of the week and a half. I'm just wondering what you make of how it's evolved.
Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked that because, you know, I had been reading this story, and basically every time I read another story about it, I'm kind of like unpacking all of this and trying to understand it again. And here's what I was really struggling with last night, which is that suddenly we're not just thinking about Rachel Dolezal. We're also thinking about that story in the context of this tragedy that happens
absolutely
in Charleston. And what I was thinking about last night was how white people who do something terrible are treated by the media compared to what happens to black people who are treated by the media. When you watch the news and you see things like Eric Garner and Michael Brown, the media instantly is jumping out there saying, well, what did this person do? What's this person's background? What is the content of their character that has gotten them to this situation where they're being killed by police officers? Contrast that with what happened with Rachel Dolezal. She's being offered reality television gigs. She is going to be able to benefit from what has happened here. You know, even though her actions were resoundingly criticized and condemned, she's going to be able to turn this into something that is profitable to herself.
So that's our top story for the week. We're going to move now into our underreported stories of the week. And Sarah Ann Lloyd of Seattle-ish, let's start with you.
So my underreported story of the week is actually something that I haven't really seen reported this week. It's been ongoing for the past month, and that is the closure of the High Point classroom of Middle College High School. So part of the idea is, ideally, that they have a community partner that is a college. There's technically one high school within the Seattle Public Schools and multiple classrooms within that high school, so that this program was able to be closed really, really quietly because it's not technically a program per se. So the Middle College serves mostly at-risk youth from disenfranchised communities. that have not been able to have their needs met by traditional high schools. The minimum enrollment age is 16. So these are kids that have already been trying and struggling at other high schools and have had a lot of trouble getting enough credits to graduate. So this is a program that really seeks to close achievement gaps, which we're still really seeing in Seattle right now, especially with students in the South End. So the school district line on this, from what I understand, is that they had decreased enrollment and they were no longer technically associated with a college because they are no longer at their South Seattle College location. So there's been a small, because it's a small school, but a very, very loud opposition to this, but very little traction and response from the district.
Are there other places for these students to go?
So they're able to enroll in any other middle college location, but the next closest is in First Hill. They can go to their neighborhood high school, which they go to middle college because that didn't work out. Or, I mean, they could probably apply to be in any of the other programs. I think the only one serving South Seattle right now is Southlake.
Wow. Well, thanks for that underreported story, Sarah Ann Lloyd. And Aaron Burkhalter, how about you? What is your underreported story?
Yeah, my underreported story is about Share. And Share is the, you know, this very grassroots, self-managed shelter organization. They also run Tent City 3 in North Seattle and Tent City 4 on the east side. And they are in the middle this month of a month-long series of outdoor campouts to raise awareness to kind of what their financial concerns are. And the reason is they're trying to raise awareness for the fact that they've basically, you know, got $60,000, you know, behind in their operations due to a variety of things, due to, you know, the cost of continuing to operate the same shelters that they've been operating for years has gone up. But most crucially, they applied for a $20,000 grant that they normally get every year. They asked for more this year, and they got none instead. But the other side of it is that Mayor Ed Murray in December had this unsheltered task force to come up with plans for how to deal with, how to get more people off of the street and into some kind of shelter quickly. And that group had quite a few recommendations. And the mayor took a few of them and did, in fact, expand, you know, shelter beds. But what it didn't address, you know, this group really asked for an emergency declaration. They asked for the mayor to open up city property and open up community centers and all these other places for much, much more shelter. And the contrast that I find in this is what we see is even though we've added some capacity, the existing shelter structure, things like this are happening all the time. Mm. You know, Share will run into a financial situation because a grant has hurt them, or another shelter will have been in a location and suddenly construction has moved them into another place. So our existing infrastructure, you know, really needs some support to try to continue to operate and house people.
All right. Well, thanks for that underreported story, Aaron Burkhalter. And Phyllis Letcher, what is your underreported story?
The GEO Group has opened a private prison in Michigan. This is one of those stories where the news is reported totally differently here versus there. So in Michigan, it's reported, you know, basically with the press release of the GEO Group and that this is job creating and things like that. Here, it's barely reported at all, but the news is that Washington State has signed a contract with the GEO Group to send up to 1,000 prisoners to this for-profit prison in Michigan. And we've reported it here on KPLU through Austin Jenkins and the Northwest News Network, but I haven't seen it covered much at all. And so this week, the development was there was legislative testimony of family members of prisoners saying, This is bad. You know, it's not just inconvenient for families. It creates a poorer outcome upon release for people to be separated from their families and not have these family visits.
Well, thank you, guys. Eye-opening as ever. Phyllis Fletcher is managing editor of Northwest News Network. Aaron Burkhalter is senior reporter at Real Change. And Sarah Ann Lloyd is writer for Seattle-ish. Thanks, guys, for being on the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today's theme is toilets. Toilets for the whole hour. I'm right now in Thurston County near Rochester, Washington, which is in between Olympia and Centralia. And I came here today on a quest. So you may remember a few years ago, the city of Seattle went out and spent $5 million on 5 shiny, state-of-the-art, automated, self-cleaning public toilets. And the idea was that you had a bunch of public toilets that would take care of themselves. No muss, no fuss. It was going to be great. But it wasn't really that great. In fact, they turned into these little havens for illegal activity. You could go inside, shut the door, lock it, and then feel free to do drugs or partake of prostitution or do any number of things that you probably wouldn't do out in the open. And then on top of that, the garbage and the filth just piled up, messed up the cleaning mechanisms. They were broken all the time. These toilets were a total boondoggle. And so instead of paying out the nose to maintain these things year after year, these toilets that weren't even working the way that they were supposed to, the city of Seattle decided to unload them. And so they listed them on eBay, hoping to recoup as much money as they could. The $5 million public toilets wound up selling for just over $12,000. So who got that huge bargain, and what became of Seattle's fancy toilets? Well, that is exactly what I'm here today to find out.
All right, big good. Good luck.
Yep. You want to introduce yourself for starters? Maybe tell me your name and where we are.
Okay. We're South Sound Speedway. My name's Butch Ben.
South Sound Speedway is what exactly?
It's a 3/8-mile oval track, and fortunately, we are the lucky people that inherited the $5 million toilets from the city of Seattle.
Are there some way where I can see?
Yes, we're going to look at them right now.
So here we are. I kind of can't believe I'm actually looking at the real artifact. Can you describe what it looks like?
Oh, it's a round building. It's 11 feet round and weighs 14,000 pounds. It's self-cleaning. And there's my well house, and I was 4 feet too close, so the county made me move it.
Oh, you had to move this. How much did you say the thing weighed? 14,000 pounds?
14,000 pounds.
So you had to move a 14,000-pound bathroom.
It was right here.
Oh, my gosh. Because you were 4 feet too close to the well.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
So does this thing work?
Oh, it works fine. I just haven't used it since because they kind of upset me a little.
Wait, so you got it padlocked right now, right?
Yeah, but I'll show you a couple that are open. We'll go down the other end.
Okay. So Butch, what made you decide to put a bid in on these things?
Well, a friend of mine from Canada told me it was up for bid, and when they first started, they wanted like 40 or 50,000 apiece. And then in the end, when they were free, I was in.
But how did it even occur to you, like, wow, I'm in the market for a stainless steel, automated, self-cleaning toilet?
And honestly, I didn't really feel that I was in the market for them, but you got to have something when it's a good buy in your life. And I've been in the garbage business before I ever came here for 10 years. So you buy stuff and you put it in the corner.
What kind of garbage business do you mean?
I was in the residential garbage business in Victoria from when I was 20 to 30 years old, so I learned quite a bit on that.
But you still have that habit of if you see a good deal, you can't turn it down.
You gotta buy it. That's how it works in the world we live in. Jump in.
Okay. So how did it work? Like, how did you go get them? Once you bought them and you knew you were the proud new owner.
Okay, we took 3 semi-trucks with big trailers, and we hired a guy with a big crane.
So you had to hire a crane to pick them up and lift them onto flatbeds?
Yeah. It cost me just about $20,000 to get everything home.
So you paid almost twice as much to move them as you did to buy them?
Right, yep.
What did you think you were going to use them for?
I don't know. I just thought it'd be a nice toy to have.
So you got 3 of them sitting. Oh, 4. There they are, all 4.
I got all 5. I've never sold one. Come and look at the back here. This is going to blow your mind.
All right, let's check it out. So we're looking in the back hatch where all the guts and mechanical and electronic stuff is.
Look at how involved this thing is. It's unbelievable. Look at the wiring in it. See, that's what they look like when they're open.
Oh, wow. Here, come on in. Let's check it out.
Okay, and you see that floor, how it tilts? When you sit the automatic thing to wash, it does it automatically and it goes down and drains out. They look like brand new.
What do you think about the whole project, you know, Seattle's project of buying these things and thinking they were going to be the solution and then finding out that they didn't work out so good?
I honestly can't believe that they give up on them. I just can't. They were so far into these things. How do you quit? And now they're going to start over again? I don't know what to say. It just blows my mind.
They didn't want to throw good money after bad, right? They didn't want to pay to maintain them if they weren't going to work.
Well, I think they did work. It's just the people was the problem. They had people that were living in them. That was their problem. Other than that, the toilets did what they were supposed to do, okay? That wasn't the issue here. I feel sorry for everybody involved in this thing. It's all bad.
Except down here?
Oh, no, it's all good. I like it.
Do you think there's anything out of them that you could salvage?
No, not for me. But I'm thinking somewhere a park's going to come and ask for one or something, and I'll help them out.
Yeah, so you think you could do somebody a favor one of these days?
Sure, one day.
So what does it say to you that you had a machine that works as it was supposed to, as you said? It's pretty sophisticated stuff, like a lot of thinking and money went into the design of these things. But what they didn't bank on was the behavior of the humans who were actually going to use them.
I know, and that you're exactly right. And I mean, I'll never forget when we went and picked them up. There were a lot of people there. They obviously were people that lived on the street, you know, and they were mad. What do you do?
Do you regret the purchase at all?
No, 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 no.
Why not?
Because I got a lot of PR out of these toilets. People that never knew who I was know who I am. And I go anywhere, people walk up and say, there's the guy who bought the toilets.
Really?
Oh, really.
When's the last time that happened to you?
A week ago, in the bank. And the guy says, there's the toilet, man.
So now the city of Seattle is getting something called the Portland Loo, which is, it looks a lot like this, but it's got some key differences. What do you make of that?
Yeah, the big difference is it's $100,000 cheaper, right? And you can see up through them so people can't sleep in them, I guess.
So with the insight that you've got now on this whole project, does that seem like a smart move or not?
If they were smart, they'd phone me up, make a deal, take them back, put them back in the hole.
Well, make an offer.
Well, they'll phone.
Let's do it right here. How much would you sell these things for?
Oh, I would sell all of them for $75,000. Everybody has to make a dollar.
Including Butch Bain here at South Sound Speedway, the proud owner of Seattle's 5 space-age automated toilets that are now mostly sitting on railroad ties and sort of in dry dock right now.
Yeah, they're sleeping. They're having a snooze.
Well, thanks for being on our show, Butch.
Hey, it's all good. You'll get lots of heat over this conversation.
Oh, you think so?
I know so.
Well, as you just heard, Seattle is getting ready to take another run at this public toilet thing by purchasing at least one Portland Loo. Those loos are descendants of the automated toilets, but they have some key differences very carefully engineered into them. One of the evangelists of the Portland Loo is a woman named Carol McCreary, who co-founded the group Public Hygiene Lets Us Stay Human, or FLUSH. And she cares more about public restrooms than almost anybody I've ever met. In fact, she sees them as a basic right. For her, this goes back to having lived and worked in developing countries. And one of the things that she and her family had to get used to there was how those countries thought differently about toilets. And specifically, they seemed to have a lot more public toilets.
Then we moved back to the States, to Portland. My husband's disabled. And we just had a terrible time finding toilets.
Do you remember any particular time when you were out trying to find a bathroom or you know, had the call of nature come calling and you had difficulty figuring out what to do?
Not so much confrontations, because middle-class white people do not have confrontations when they ask to use a private toilet in a mercantile establishment. But what we find that more and more people, like families like ours, are doing is we are organizing our days around where the available toilets are. There are groups of people we can consider restroom challenged. In other words, they need a facility either every hour at least or urgently. They include, old, very young, very old, the pregnant women, people with mobility disabilities, people with invisible disabilities. And they represent at any one time a very high proportion of the U.S. public, 20 or 30%.
If we kind of rewind the tape here to, like, say, 100 years ago, it sounds like public toilets were a lot more common. And maybe even a lot nicer. You know, there was in Pioneer Square in downtown Seattle, the same place that the city of Seattle is looking finally at getting a Portland Lou. Around the turn of the century, there was a rather famous underground comfort station full of public toilets, and it had attendants, and it was really nice. Mm-hmm. It was considered one of the nicest toilets in the Western U.S. That seems like it wasn't all that uncommon at the time. What were the attitudes about public bathrooms, in the early to, you know, the first half of the 20th century?
Yeah, so the Pacific Northwest does seem to be very progressive there. As far as I know, the very first public toilet was a Rotary Club service project in Chicago in 1909. And then up here in Portland and Seattle and probably Victoria and Vancouver, we see in the 20s these comfort stations, and some of them very sophisticated underground comfort stations. Let's look at the Victorian expectations, because that's a big part of it. Victorians were sort of had a sense of fecal denial and class differentiation. So when you brought along a flush toilet that took everything away, they rather went for it. There's a very interesting book by a guy called Dave Prager called Poop Culture, How America is Shaped by Its Grossest National Product. He says, everyone knows that everyone poops, but everyone poops using apparatuses designed to create the appearance that no one does. Our infrastructure makes invisible what our bodies make universal, and a tremendous social contradiction is the result.
What lessons are there about human nature to be drawn from the experiences of cities like Seattle and other cities that had problematic public restroom experiments?
Well, when our group was doing research, Flush looked at Seattle, and even before Seattle installed those automatic public toilets, we sort of thought they wouldn't work because they hadn't worked in the United States. What we've been fighting for on the design side is some kind of a private, secure, comfortable space, which nonetheless has some kind of connection with the street, where you don't go from complete public to complete privacy, but you have the equivalent of some space under the door where you can see if someone has fallen or overdosed or is in difficulty of some kind, or where you have far too many feet.
Should that make us pessimistic about human nature in some way, that without somebody keeping an eye on people, that our tendency, if we're able to close the door and lock it, is to misbehave?
No, I don't think so. I think it's more, there's sort of an oxymoron in the term public toilet, because we're performing the most private of all acts in a public space. That's strange and interesting in itself. And we need to change that and integrate, build into our shared urban space safe, comfortable, workable, affordable toilets and restrooms.
But just to press this a little bit more, I mean, it's just tempting to sort of look at this and say, you know, this is revealing our true selves in some ways. This is what happens when nobody is watching, is we go in there, we make messes, we do drugs, we do other kinds of activities that are generally frowned upon by society. This is who we are.
My feeling is that public restrooms need that love and care of the public. They need the eyes of the public on them all the time. And I'd even like to go further and say that they should be great design. They can incorporate public art. They might even be public art. That puts positive attention, natural surveillance of the community on the facility.
So what do you say to folks who say it's just not worth it? It's not worth the trouble and the expense. And the people who need this most, who are often unhoused people, homeless people, maybe we shouldn't be making the public spaces quite so comfortable for them to live in all the time anyway. So how do you confront that kind of an attitude?
That goes against all good sense. First of all, toilet availability is a human right. The United Nations has taken a firm stand on this. It's a necessary condition of mental and physical health.
Why is this so basic to you, and why does it matter so much to you? Why do you care so much about public toilets?
You can't participate in fully in civil society unless you're clean. You can't keep your job if you can't stay clean. We also would include showers in there, but you certainly have to be able to avoid soiling yourself. Right now, with the economic crunch, many of our homeless people are people who live in their vehicles or who couch surf. Many of them are employed, and that restroom, that sink where they can wash up, makes the difference between them keeping the job they have and losing it. It's at the very basis of being human, participating in society, and having the right to earn a livelihood and move on with your life.
Carol McCreary is a co-founder of Public Hygiene Lets Us Stay Human, which is a Portland-based nonprofit. Its acronym spells out FLUSH. We reached her by Skype on an island in the middle of a sailing trip. So thank you for being game to chat, and we really appreciate your time on Sound Effect.
Thank you so much, Gabriel, for covering this issue.
You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. We have been talking about toilets today. So excited about our toilet show. And talking about some of the ways that they provide a window into society's inner workings. And one of the things that bathrooms do, especially public bathrooms, is sort us. You know, if you look like the plain stick figure, you go into the men's room. If you look like the stick figure with a little skirt, it's off to the women's room. But obviously, not everyone fits into one or other of those categories. And for transgender people, this can be like an imposed identity crisis on you every time you have to pee. And it's not just about labels. For a lot of trans people, it's an issue of personal safety. So we caught up with Dani Aschini of the Gender Justice League in Seattle, and we asked her to explain how she chose which bathroom to use as she transitioned from male to female.
The first time I encountered the like notion that maybe I was in the wrong bathroom was my sophomore year of high school. And this was, you know, just before I had made the decision to transition, but my gender was pretty androgynous or ambiguous to most people. And I went into the men's room one day and encountered a boy who said, "Faggots use the women's room." And it was so scary and violent that I immediately left the bathroom, went and found one of my female friends and got her to escort me into the women's room. And so for the rest of high school, much to the consternation of the administration, I ended up using mostly the girls' restrooms, usually with friends who would bring me in there, and found that to be quite safe, actually.
Did anyone give you a hard time about that?
Absolutely. I think there are definitely girls who would like act disgusted or be annoyed and like walk straight out of the bathroom if they saw me in there. I usually try to be very quick when going to the bathroom. You know, it was like straight in, straight out. And as I transitioned and presented in a way that people felt more comfortable with, I encountered a little bit less of that.
So let's explain why we're even talking about this. How large does this issue loom for trans people?
Huge. I think that bathrooms, you know, it's so big that OSHA, the Occupational Safety Health Administration, the Department of Labor just issued guidelines clarifying for employers the rights of transgender employees to access the bathroom. And I don't know a trans person in my life, and I know thousands of trans people, who doesn't have a bathroom story where they've either been confronted or approached or scared to use the bathroom. And so I think it's definitely an issue for all trans people, but it's really not an issue for us. It's an issue for cisgender people who encounter us in the bathroom.
Cisgender people being normative gendered people?
Yeah, so non-transgender people. Yep.
Yeah. So it's interesting to me because it's an issue for trans people in a way that, you know, cisgendered people don't have to think about almost ever.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think because of that like unthinkingness of just like going into the bathroom and assuming you're just going to see, you know, women or men, and it's a gender segregated space. It's the only generally public gender segregated space that still exists in a very real way for everybody every day. And so when you encounter a trans person or even just a gender non-conforming person, it suddenly elevates this tension, this anxiety of gender in a way that people are not prepared for or don't anticipate. And it's that lack of anticipation of that encounter that often creates this response from people that can be good, bad, or indifferent.
Well, I wonder, I mean, there is definitely a certain percentage of the population that must be rolling their eyes right now saying, oh boy, this is like PC run amok. When there's such a, you know, when it's a relatively small percentage of the population mm-hmm. who are trans, are we supposed to re-engineer all of this stuff to cater to a small minority of people? And when you get that, or if you don't get that, let's pretend you do, well, you know, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think about the immense amount of violence, the disproportionate and incredible amount of violence that transgender people face just in their daily life, just walking down the street. So 90% of transgender people experience some form of harassment or discrimination in the workplace, and that comes from the National Transgender Discrimination Survey. Almost 25% of transgender people have been physically assaulted at some point in their life. And that number is higher for African American transgender women and lowest for Caucasian transgender men. But it's violence is a very real threat for transgender people in using the bathroom. And so it is, I think it's challenging, and there's a lot of mythology and feelings and attachments to these gender segregated spaces. But it definitely is problematic for trans people. It exposes us to a lot more danger. And I think particularly there's a lot of focus in the community between pitting women against transgender women and women feeling the transgender women being in the bathroom that they might be a threat or be hostile. And the statistical reality is that transgender women are exceptionally more likely to encounter violence in their day-to-day life. And it's not to say that cisgender women don't experience tons of violence, and we absolutely have a cultural systemic problem with violence against women. But transgender women, the idea of sending transgender women into a men's room is above and beyond that transgender woman is very likely to experience significant violence.
So what's the solution as far as you're concerned? What would you like to see change?
I think the solution is, you know, what the law in Washington state theoretically states, you know, and that it should be practiced, is that transgender people should be allowed to use the bathroom that is consistent with their gender identity. And the people, when they encounter transgender people in the bathroom, are just humble and about it and compassionate and understand people are just going there to go to the bathroom. And that's something that, you know, is a bodily function that we have to take care of. It is a need of the human body.
So it's less about changing the bathrooms than it is about changing the people. Attitudes.
Yeah, totally. Which is like, you know, if you see somebody in the bathroom, they probably just need to be there and just let them be there and let them like go through that space. And so I think that that's really the work that needs to happen.
Well, finally, there are big changes in attitudes about gender afoot in society. Obviously, a long way to go from many transgendered people's point of view. But things are changing. Mm-hmm. Do you think you are going to see changes around this issue, the issue of bathrooms, how we divide up our bathrooms, how we designate who gets to go where, etc.?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we will, over time, hopefully see more acceptance. And if anything, just people being neutral. You know, they might not necessarily agree with the fact that people are trans, but are willing to let people be who they are, be free to be themselves, and live a life free from harassment and discrimination, and just let them use the bathroom. I think that we're moving in that direction and that that will be ideal. I think that people also, I know that the city council has considered a proposal to have more gender neutral bathrooms in city buildings, and that that's been done in West Hollywood and Washington, D.C. And so I think we will see more movement in this direction, and hopefully that will benefit everybody, not just transgender people.
Well, Danny Oschini is executive director of the Gender Justice League based in Seattle. Hey, thanks for talking toilets on Sound Effect.
Great. Thank you so much.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU, our Potty Talk episode. We are talking toilets this week. And up next, we're going to hear from Carl Hensman, who works for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He is a program officer for the Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene Program. But, you know, if you met him at a cocktail party and ask him what he does,
I say I deal with
And that is true. He works on solutions around toilets and sanitation systems for the 2.4 billion people around the world who currently live without safe sanitation. And to do that, you have to navigate infrastructure and water resources and religion and politics. You really have to understand a place and its people in order to design something safe for them to poop in. And for Carl, this is an urgent task. He says sanitation is a major global health issue. In fact, Hensman says the flush toilet was one of the most important advancements in public health, period. And he's not alone.
The S-bend is the key. So there was a journal that had been in place, and they said to their members, all of their members, I think like 11,000 or something, what do you think as a medical community was the most important global health impact of the last 150 years since we've been a journal? And all of them put the toilet at number one. And when you think about the S-bend trap with water, what it does is it doesn't just stop the smell, but it stops the flies going down, and it stops all the vectors that bring all those pathogens back up.
That little bit of porcelain, they're saying, is the most effective medical or public health innovation in 150 years, more so than antibiotics, more so than chemotherapy, more so than, I don't know what else.
Vaccines.
How can that be?
Because the number of people that benefited from removing them from the pathogens of human waste equates directly to the number of people that have a much healthier environment because of that. But the sad thing about it is this all happened, that S-bend, the flush toilet, it was first invented 250, 270 years ago, and it still is in less than a third of the globe's houses.
As somebody who's thinking about design, who's thinking about programs, who's thinking about what it takes to get people to actually adopt the solutions that are presented to them, what are the barriers that you're able to wrestle with?
So for 30 or 40 years, a lot of sanitation, and I'm going to be very generalistic, is making better holes in the ground. Yeah, and people will come in and they'll see people defecating in the open, and they'll be terrified by this, or they'll be horrified. And emotionally, they might want to make that separation.
When you say people will come in, you mean like people from rich countries will come in?
Yeah, NGOs, well-meaning people. They'll go for the instant situation of being able to dig a pit latrine, put a septic tank in, and separate people from their waste. That's fantastic, but then they'll leave. And they don't think, what happens to it now? So that's one of the biggest emphasis we have in our team is, how do you make this sustainable?
So what's one really cool new idea you've heard in toilets that tackles that problem?
We're working with some really smart people out of the UK that are using urine to basically power microbial fuel cells that can charge your cell phone at the moment. They're actually just about to put 10 stalls in with Oxfam in the Glastonbury Music Festival in the UK that will be self-powered from the urine from the people at the music festival. So the bacteria will eat all the material within the urine, and one of the byproducts of the bacteria is electrons. And then you capture those electrons and use those as power.
Cool. What about this core problem of not only separating people from their waste, but making it and doing it in a sustainable way? Is there a really good design solution to that, or a promising one?
So you're touching, I'm a egghead technical guy. And what you're doing is you're touching on an area that I think is the hardest thing that has to be done, and that's the business model. You have to create a situation where people want to service the systems because they're going to make money from it, or there's going to be value, or this supply chain that makes people would want to effectively turn shit into a commodity.
Even in places with widespread open defecation, there's often huge taboos on talking about bodily functions like this. How do you even begin to manage that stuff?
It's not really how we can manage it. We, you know, within the WASH group at the foundation, we can't change culture. It's how can you work with the culture to develop your message in a way that it doesn't get into that difficult area of taboo. A lot of it comes from, you know, my colleagues that deal with change behavior. And this is very much a long-term generational thing. Basically trying to help kids understand better sanitation techniques. And you'll find that the kids will go home and start to dictate to the parents. And you may have to go a very long period of time through that education process. There's an education piece that can happen within the schools without interfering with the concept of what people do and don't want to talk about in their own culture, because that's not for us to change.
What have you learned about human nature
through the lens of the toilet, the design problems of the toilet, the global health implications of toilets and sanitation. What has that taught you about human beings?
That we all love to talk about poop, and we all want to try and figure out how to do it better. I don't mean how to poop better, but how to get rid of it better. You know, I think there's an intrinsic understanding that it isn't a waste, that there is a resource is in there, right? And so when you can get people over the ick factor, then you have some amazing conversations with people you had never thought about, and they start to talk about it more in a very sort of resource recovery, you know, reclamation of water, you know, what you can do with it type of mode. And
can you think of an example of that?
There's one of the compost that you buy that actually has a product in it called Loop. Loop is the biosolids that come from our treatment plants in King County. And no one really thinks about this, but when they do, you know, some people will be like, oh, wow, that's great. I'm actually using my own poop, processed poop, in my garden to help my tomatoes grow. The Washington apple growers will take the biosolids as well. So if you're eating apples that are grown in Washington, they've got some biosolids fertilizer in there and they're growing there. And once people can get past the ick factor, they actually very excited about what could be done. And it doesn't become that icky conversation, that nasty conversation.
Do you have any techniques to help people get over the ick factor?
I'm pretty blunt. I've actually fascinated myself that I haven't used any of the words you're not allowed to use on the radio so far.
You did.
Oh, good, good, good. I've done some presentations where if it's a crowd that seems a little squirmy, or it's a crowd that's just fun. I was giving a presentation for a bunch of K through 12 STEM teachers, and I get them all to stand up and just shout at the loudest they can. I mean, I think we had 75 global reporters do it once at the foundation, and it just breaks. Just like you're doing now, you know, you start laughing about it, and you realize it's not that big of a, you know, it's not that icky big of a problem.
Well, it's been an interesting experiment for our staff this week as we have prepared for our toilet show, to try our best not to indulge in the easy puns and stuff like that. Do you think we should just go for it?
I was going to ask, why not? You should. I mean, that's you know, that's part of the fun of all this. And that's also, you know, where you break these things down again and you have much more open conversations. When you think about what the toilet is to us in a house. We go in and we shut the door and we sit down and we read our newspaper, whatever, and we do our business, and then we flush it away and we get rid of it and we wash our hands, hopefully, and we walk out and we shut the door again. And it's hidden away, and we never talk about it. And yet it's something that everybody does every single day. It's something you contribute to the environment that needs to be treated properly. You pay for it. It's a fundamental part of our life. And I don't mean everyone should just suddenly start talking about toilets, but any way possible to make it not so neglected in conversation would be fantastic. And if that means really, really bad puns, you know, fantastic. You know, you should go and do that, you know?
Carl Hensman is a program officer for water, hygiene, and sanitation at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Well, thank you very much, Gabe.
Sound Effect comes to you from our own number one, senior producer Arwin Nix, from producer Kevin Kniestad, and from Matthew Strybe and intern Bree Ripley. We are flush with talent this week. Look, he said run with the toilet puns, okay? I've been so good this whole time, I'm just bursting. Anyway, our executive producer is Aaron the Plunger Hennessy. We had web help from Mike the Tank Lewis. Arwin, can I really get away with this?
I will allow you to have all of these toilet puns if you give me 1 second to wish a happy Father's Day to John Nix, the man who taught me how to use a toilet.
Happy Father's Day, John Nix and John Spitzer. We're on iTunes. Subscribe to our podcast there. And if you really want our undying gratitude, write us a short review. You can also send feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org. Come on back next week. Kevin Kniestad's going to be in the host chair, taking us to the point of no return.
I have ghost things that I like sometimes, like even today, I'll be like, oh, I want to hear this record. And I'll go over and start looking for it. I'm like, oh yeah, old record collection.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KPLU.